It's been about a week since Americans chose a new leader. President-elect Donald Trump takes office in January. That's got a lot of people on the left and the right trying to guess at how he'll govern and what he'll do on important issues like the economy and healthcare. What will a President Trump administration mean for the Sunshine State? That's ahead on It's About Florida. Welcome to It's About Florida. I'm your host, Lynn Hatter. Donald Trump's election as President of the United States is being met with excitement, fear, and uncertainty across the political spectrum. For his supporters, a Trump presidency means a greater focus on the economy, on business. Trump himself has called for putting America first. But what does that look like? Joining us in the studio is Bob McClure, president of the free market think tank, the James Madison Institute. Bob McClure, welcome to It's About Florida. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start this conversation off with something that came out. We're now a week after the election. Mr. Trump is going to be our next president. Some people are thrilled. Some people are not. What is the feeling over at JMI, the James Madison Institute?
Well, I think the short answer is no one actually knows how he's going to govern. We all know what he said. We all know what he ran on. And we all know what he says he's going to do in terms of all of the issues that are important to Floridians. But I think the reality is we don't know. He's just appointed two people to his inner staff, his chief of staff, Reince Priebus, who's more considered kind of an insider, for lack of a better term, his former head of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. But then also he appointed Steve Bannon, who is kind of his idea strategist during the election. And Steve Bannon is in no way, shape, or form a part of the establishment. So it looks to me, at least with these first two appointments, that he kind of gave one for each side if we're discussing simply the Republican Party establishment versus the outsiders. And so I don't know that we know how he's going to govern just yet.
And I think that's really kind of the question. I hear a lot of people saying, well, we don't know. Even the state estimating conference, the economic estimating conference, came out with its national outlook yesterday. And a core tenet is we don't know what his policies will look like, nor do we know what they will mean for the future of our economy. You all are a think tank. You all deal with these kind of really high level policy issues. What would you like to see in a President Trump's administration?
Well, you know, I think if you look at what people call his, quote, Gettysburg Address, end quote, which is if you Google the, you know, Donald mm-hmm. Trump's Gettysburg Address, which is a speech he gave in Gettysburg a couple of weeks, very symbolic, before the election. The things he discusses in that speech, 85 to 90% of it, we would argue, will jumpstart what has been essentially a moribund economy. While we have kind of bumped along the bottom, slow and steady, the reality is we haven't had 3% growth in 8 years. And President Obama, regardless of what one thinks of his politics, is the first president in the 20th or 21st century not to have 3% growth ever during his administration. So what a President Trump has said he will do, and that's all we can go on, correct, is that he's going to lower taxes across the board. He's going to reduce the regulations that small businesses must deal with on a daily basis because they drive up the cost of doing business. He's going to repeal Obamacare, but keep a couple of the items that are very, very popular, staying on your parents' health care for until you're 26. And then obviously pre-existing conditions component, both of which are very popular, and there's nothing wrong with that. But he's going to roll back the regulatory component that is driving up costs that I think really affected the election when we were seeing spike in premiums 25%. So if he cuts taxes, rollbacks regulations, and changes Obamacare to become more consumer-friendly than it currently is, I think it will take some time. But if he sticks to those, I think you'll see an economy begin to jumpstart in the next year.
You know, I want to want to tackle this issue of 3% growth because the economy has been growing, but it's been growing, I think, slower than a lot of people would like. The first part of my question is, how did we get to 3% as the golden figure, the type of growth that we would like to see? And I think the second part of that question is, our economy in general has changed. We have moved from a making things economy to a consumption and information technology economy. And how has that impacted the growth rate?
Well, I think if you look at the 3% growth rate, the reason it becomes kind of the marker in the sand, if you will, is because those are the that percentage is the important component of the number of jobs we need to add to continue to drive down unemployment. Now, there are a lot of different ways to measure unemployment, as your listeners know, but that 3% marker is the kind of line in the sand that says we are driving down unemployment and we are seeing growth occur. That's why 3% is picked. It's chosen. The reality is we do have a changing economy, to your second question. You're absolutely right. We do not have the manufacturing widget economy that we used to have. We have moved more into a services economy. Manufacturing has left the country for lots of different reasons that we could debate. And that's one area where a Trump administration has said they are going to bring back manufacturing jobs. There are those on both sides of the aisle who say that'll never happen, that we have moved beyond that and that we actually don't want to be a manufacturing economy. We want to be a services and technology-driven economy. And that's a discussion I think is a fair one to have. But, so we will see whether he's able to do that. I don't think – and again, No one can predict this administration. I don't think he's promising a return to the early 20th century Rust Belt world. Mm-hmm. But what I do think he is at least going to try to do is to bring back certain kinds of manufacturing jobs, corporate jobs, not corporate jobs, but corporations that provide jobs to the local economy, whether it's car making or technology or whatever the case may be. And so nobody is suggesting that we go back to the early 20th century, assembly line economy. I think what he's thinking is to bring back those jobs into it's kind of like the South emerging in the 60s, 70s, and 80s to become really this vibrant Sunbelt economy, the Southeast. And I think that's the same vision that a President Trump seems to have.
We're talking advanced manufacturing. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of jobs that we're talking about, and I think you've alluded to. These are the ones that do take a certain level of skill in order to fulfill. One of the things that we've been hearing frequently in the past couple of years is the question of whether or not we have the workforce with the proper training to fulfill those jobs. And we've already seen certain companies that did move overseas have begun to come back. So I think the question is, what do we need to do to make sure that the workforce has the proper training to fulfill those jobs if and when they come back?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a very, very good observation. For years, we have, for whatever reason, I think, regardless of who was in power, but there's been kind of this emerging view in America that everyone has to go to college, and not everyone does. There are lots of opportunities to pursue one's own American dream, however they want to define that, by learning a skill and a trade and running a small business or just working for a small business. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of retraining and a lot of opportunity. Not everyone needs to or should go to college. Lots of good people who are chasing the same American dream as everyone else can go to a vocational school and learn a trade and do very, very well in their life, provide for their children and their grandchildren.
Now, a second part of this question, you know, it is geared towards small businesses. And there are two things that I've heard when I have talked to many of the small businesses here in Tallahassee are two concerns. One is the price of healthcare, which goes to the issue of, you know, if you're super low income, you're good with Obamacare. But where it really begins to hit people in the pocketbook is small businesses, and there's those beginning at about $35,000 a year. Those are the people who are seeing these really big, steep climbs. And the second issue is the Fair Labor and Standards Act, which goes into effect in December. Not a lot of people have talked about this, but those are new rules that say, you know, a manager making under $45,000 a year now would still qualify for additional overtime pay. It raised how much money you have to pay people to get away, you know, without paying them overtime. That has been a really big concern for businesses. Not a lot of people have talked about that. And I actually haven't even heard President-elect Trump talk about that on the campaign trail. How big of an issue is starting first with FLSA?
I think it's a huge issue, and it really is kind of the iceberg under the water as the Titanic approaches. You have employees that the federal government has essentially said, if you're making $47,000 a year or less, that you're entitled to overtime over 40 hours a week. Well, what you're going to see is you're not going to see businesses, to use a double negative, not control those costs. They're going to control those costs. And what that's going to mean is they're not going to add more workers. They're going to cut hours. They're going to ride herd on what is and isn't considered overtime. They're going to lower salaries. What the federal government has tried to do here is just magic more money for employees. And that's just simply not the way the economy works. You can't just say, you know, wave a magic wand and say, well, this is now going to happen and people are going to get paid more. It just simply won't work. And so what small businesses will do, and large businesses, is that they will essentially cut back their workforce. They will decrease hours. They will lower salaries and benefits and those kinds of things because they have to control costs. That's what a business has to do. Much like raising the minimum wage, which is this kind of false belief that raising the minimum wage helps working families. It actually hurts working families because it increased the cost of doing business. And so small businesses simply aren't going to employ more people. And that's what you're going to see happen in December. It will be interesting to see how quickly the Trump administration moves to get rid of that executive order.
I feel like we're at the intersection between to regulate / enforce or not to regulate / enforce. How do you balance that?
Well,
is there a middle ground?
Yes, I think there is. I think we at the James Madison Institute would say that obviously there is a proper role for government. But the role of government is to be like a referee at a football game, almost hard to see, except when the difficult calls need to be made, or an outstanding waiter at a restaurant, okay? The light hand of government. The referee should not be the ball game. And in too many areas, whether it's the environment or healthcare or the effects on small business, in too many areas, the referee has become the ball game. You know, you never want the waiter to be the funniest guy at the table, or you never want the waiter to be inserting him or herself or waitress him or herself into the meal. It is the light hand and the light touch of government. Set the parameters, hold people accountable, but then allow them to do their job. And that's what needs to happen in and around Lake Okeechobee. That's what needs to happen in healthcare, and that's what needs to happen with small businesses. The government has, in the last not just 8 years, really in the last probably 12 to 16 years, has really inserted itself in every single area of the American taxpayers' lives. And I think what you saw Tuesday night again was not a vote for conservatism. It was a vote for just leave me alone and let me do my job.
Well, Mr. McClure, thank you so much for joining us today on It's About Florida.
Thank you so much for having me.
What Mr. Trump has said he will and won't do on issues like immigration and healthcare, even foreign policy, appears to be changing. And some say that's not unusual for a brand new administration with no previous governing experience. Some see that as a good thing. But on the left, Trump's election is worrying. Damian Filer is with Progress Florida, an organization dedicated to promoting progressive values. Damian Filer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start off with asking you, you know, what did you make of the election outcome?
Well, as a student of politics, I was fascinated by it on a number of levels. If you look at it from a Florida perspective, one thing that was interesting to me was that obviously in Donald Trump, we had a very non-traditional Republican nominee. And one thing that ended up being somewhat non-traditional about the results, if you look at Florida and other places, is that he really didn't have the kind of coattails that you may have expected from such a resounding victory. If you look here at our state results, more local results in Florida, the Democrats actually made modest gains at the state House level, at the state Senate level, in the congressional delegation. And there were two constitutional amendments on the ballot that were relatively high profile. And from my perspective as a progressive, there were positive results in both cases. There was the defeat of a utility-backed kind of sham solar amendment. And then there was also support for the medical marijuana amendment. So if you isolate those results at the state level and look at them, they seem somewhat incongruous with the Republican nominee having won at the both in Florida and at the national level. So from an academic standpoint, that's interesting to me.
So basically there, at least in Florida, there is no such thing as, I guess, the down ballot Trump effect.
I think that's correct. And I think part of the reason for that is because he was not a traditional Republican candidate. So he was not certainly throughout the campaign. He had his share of conflicts and difficulties with prominent Republicans, including Marco Rubio, who, of course, did win re-election here in Florida. But he was not seen, I think, in many ways as the typical standard bearer for the Republican Party. And I think that that had mixed effects. I think at the end of the day, it had a positive effect for him because he was successfully able to brand himself as an outsider. So even though he ran as the nominee for one of the two major parties, I think that he was able to excite a part of the electorate that really didn't necessarily associate themselves with being typical Republican voters, or may not have voted previously at all.
And one of the things that he's talking about right now is this concept of draining the swamp, mm-hmm. getting lobbyists out of there. You all, Progress Florida, and a lot of the groups that you've worked with in the past have always advocated for that, trying mm-hmm. to decrease the influence of lobbyists in the process. Mm-hmm. We see that happening at the federal level, but we also see that happening at the state level mm-hmm. with incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran. Mm-hmm. Again, not exactly a traditional Republican viewpoint by far. What do you make of this?
Well, I make of it primarily the fact that these politicians from Donald Trump to Richard Corcoran, who are now preparing to move into leadership positions in their respective positions, have read the writing on the wall from the election and seen that while voters, when they're polled in public opinion research, will always be in favor of, in essence, draining the swamp and trying to minimize the role of paid lobbyists in our of the people by the people for the people system of government, but it's usually lip service. You know, there are a lot of things if you've worked in government and been an observer of government and politics that you start to see over and over again. So things like, oh, we're going to set up a blue ribbon task force to address mm-hmm. this, or they become kind of buzzwords for certain things. You know, everybody always wants to lower taxes. Everybody always wants to. A big one that you'll hear is we're gonna cut waste. You know, everybody says that. That's not something that one party or another has the rights to, kind of as a brand. And typically, I think for both parties, when they come into power, what you see is that that there's not a lot of follow-up to those things. And I think part of the lesson that these folks and others are finding from this election is that, it's another buzzword here, it was a change election.
Mm-hmm.
Most elections are change elections because people remain unsatisfied. They try one brand, so to speak, and they don't get the results that they want. And the only option that they usually have in our system is to go to the other brand. And so they try that for a while.
It's interesting you talk about that. In 2008, President Obama ran on the platform of change.
Right.
Here you are in 2016, Donald Trump ran on the platform of change.
Right. And I think part of what we're seeing here is that this goes beyond party. I think that if you look at the world through the kind of cable news lens, everything has to be broken down into black and white and kind of yin and yang. So here's Democrats, here's Republicans kind of thing. Most people walking down the streets, living their lives, trying to pay their bills, get their kids picked up from school, even if they're registered with one party or another, they don't mm-hmm. walk around kind of associating themselves strongly necessarily, a lot of people, with that as an identity. And I think that there are a lot of things, and this Donald Trump's a good example of this, as we were talking about earlier. I think there are a lot of instances where what people's real concerns are about their lives and the way that policies will affect their lives don't fit neatly into these prescribed notions of what the two parties are, for example. And so I think that what we're seeing now is that people are really, going back to your earlier question, they're just really fed up. And I think that this, in many ways, the vote for Trump was a protest vote. In essence, I think that there were a lot of people saying, look, I may not agree with him about this, or I may have been offended by that, but I want to be heard. I want people to know that there really does need to be a significant shakeup.
So you said, like, people aren't associating with party, and yet, you know, we heard a lot about that during the election, that, you know, people feel as if they can't understand the other side. You have people who identify as conservatives saying they don't understand liberals. Mm-hmm. Is that not associating by party, but by association by philosophy? Help me understand that a little bit more. Where is the distinction? Because there is no doubt that people are, or they feel like they are, they don't understand people on the other side.
Right. I think part of the challenge that we have in our system of government with only two parties that really are overwhelmingly dominant is that there are many more viewpoints than two. And so it what happens is that it necessitates, unless you want to cast, in essence, truly a symbolic vote for someone like a libertarian, like a Johnson or
4 million people did.
Well, right. But I think that those 4 million people did so understanding that there was basically no chance that the candidate that they were voting for was actually going to win. For example, Clinton, won the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as this was an upset and was not close in the Electoral College, I certainly think that it's fair to say that our country, if you look at the totality of the votes, was very split between these two candidates. And part of what that ends up meaning is that both of these parties and both of these nominees had to represent a really broad swath of our society. So if you look, for example, at the Democratic primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, those were two very different visions
mm-hmm.
of what the Democratic Party would represent. And Bernie Sanders, much like Donald Trump, was much more successful than anyone would have initially thought. So I think that when you have only two parties to represent everybody, that a lot of different people with a lot of different viewpoints have to find a home in one or the other. And it means, for better or worse, that both of those parties have to have large and pretty diverse tents.
We now have a legislature that is still overwhelmingly Republican. Despite winning a seat or two here and there, mm-hmm. Florida Democrats, the state Democratic Party, probably as well as the National Democratic Party, is in a bit of a state of disarray. You know, as a progressive, as a Democrat, are you all pretty much just trying to be the voice of opposition? What is the influence that Democrats will have, if any?
So I think that just being the voice of opposition is never an effective way forward. So I think that that's an important role, both at all levels of government. When you're in the minority, part of the way that our system works is that the minority is still supposed to have a voice. And that is crucial. And particularly when, like I said, with some of these issues, particularly in the area of reproductive rights as an example, some of these things that have been pushed through by the state legislature and the governor here in Florida don't represent the views of the overwhelming majority of Floridians. And again, this includes Republicans. There are even Republican members of the legislature who have pushed back not only on these specific attacks that we see every year on reproductive rights, but also on the notion that with so many challenges in such a large state as Florida, to even be spending the time debating some of these issues is offensive to people across the political spectrum. But
yet that hasn't stopped Republicans from maintaining their majorities.
That's true. That's true. There's a phenomena that we see both at the state legislative level and at the congressional level where quite typically when you ask people in public opinion polls for their opinion of those bodies, what's your opinion of the Florida legislature, what's your opinion of the United States Congress, they give them very low marks, historically low marks in recent years. But the flip side is that when you turn around and say, what do you think of your representative at the state legislative or the congressional level, most people seem to think that, well, you know, my person's okay, kind of thing. And so the result of that is that cumulatively, we end up sending many of the same people back over and over again. And there also is, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but the state of Florida, even with the Fair Districts Amendments that have been passed, which have been significant and have had a meaningful impact and will continue to, hopefully in a growing way moving forward, they can't immediately undo the level of gerrymandering that we've seen in recent years in Florida and in other places. And because of that, there were, for example, a number of races where they weren't even contested in the Florida legislature. And so at the local level, people are making decisions that make sense to them there. But the cumulative effect has been leading us to legislative and congressional bodies that people feel don't represent their interests.
Thanks again to Progress Florida's Damian Filer and the James Madison Institute's Bob McClure. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Join us again next month for more discussion on the issues impacting our state.